It feels like a special privilege that we, in the chaos of the conference with everything going on, that we get to sit in a circle and have a conversation with each other, actually to become a group. And thank you all for introducing yourselves and the diversity even in the group in terms of the countries and geographic areas from where you're from, the diversity of interests that you have. I'm hoping it'll enrich our conversation even more. I'd like to begin by asking you to come with me on a journey. And I'd like you to imagine that you work with students, you supervise students, maybe with doctoral students as well. And you have a doctoral student who is a physician, an obstetrician, and she works for the Ministry of Health for her South Asian country, which happens to be Nepal. And very well-educated woman. Not only does she have a medical degree from India, but she has a master's in public health from University of Edinburgh. She has a master's degree in anthropology. She's primarily an epidemiologist. So she's interested in looking at health issues from examining data, statistics. And she's really confused and puzzled because her country has the highest maternal mortality in the world. More women die in childbirth in Nepal than anywhere else. And maybe that's not surprising considering that 90% of the population has no access to any health care whatsoever. But even when there is health care available, the women are not seeking help. They're not going to the clinics. And she cannot figure out what the heck's going on. So because the doctoral students I supervise all do qualitative research, seems to me rather obvious. Sometimes when you want to know what's going on, why don't you talk to people instead of having them fill out questionnaires? So Kieran wanted to learn qualitative research methods to do a study to look at reproductive health issues in her country, in Nepal. And without offending any physicians present, doctors are terrible interviewers because she had been trained, especially in Indian medical schools, to ask a series of very close-ended questions. You know, like, this pain you have in your abdomen, is it radiating pain or is it centralized? Would you say it's in the right of, you know, so watching her do qualitative research, you know, she would ask these questions like, oh, so are you from this or from that or from, you know, and it was ugly. So I decided that I had to start following her around the villages where she operates in Nepal to teach her how to do qualitative interviewing. So I go to Nepal, and while Kieran, every time we would go to a village, by the way, there's only 5 female physicians in Nepal for a country of 30 million people. Whenever Kieran would go to a village, like, all the women in the village would show up because, you know, the doctor is only there once a year. While Kieran was doing rounds in the village, I was just kind of hanging out. And so I'd like you to imagine that you're with me in a village in southern Nepal near the Indian border. It's called Sarnpur is the village. It's so remote that to get there, not only do you have to fly to Bangkok and then to Kathmandu and then fly to Chittawan, which is the capital city of the district, but then you have to get off the plane and walk to pick up a truck, and the truck takes you a couple hours to this village where they've never had a visitor before. You are, because you're with me, right? You're somewhat of a curiosity. So we visit a school, and because why wouldn't you want to hang out in a school while you're there? And you're watching the kids playing. And while we're there, we learn something peculiar is going on because girls are disappearing. And that's a really strange verb to use. You know, like, where's your daughter? Oh, she disappeared. She disappeared? Like, you got a magician here? Or, you know, and nobody would explain to me what this meant. This disappeared. And it's not like desaparecido in, you know, in Argentina or something. You know, it's a different, you know, different context. Girls disappearing, what's going on? So we keep asking and we can't find out what's going on until finally I'm so frustrated and perplexed that we press the principal of the school, what's with these girls disappearing? And the principal is sheepish and he's embarrassed. And finally, he says, do you see that girl over there? Look over there, because there's a girl over there. Her name is Inu. Look over there. She's over there. She's right standing over there. She's 12 years old. 12-year-old little girl. Her name is Inu, and she's standing over there talking to a friend. And the principal says to us, Inu will be disappeared next. She'll be disappeared. Oh yes, very, very sad, because she is the smartest girl in our school. And I said, well, where is she going? Very, very sad. Her father, he drinks a lot, and he's no longer there. Now, we understand what that means now, because we know in Nepal that women have no rights. So if the man, the husband, the father is not present, women do not inherit land. The land reverts back to the brothers. So women have no rights whatsoever. Inu is also lower caste. She's untouchable. In the five caste system from Brahman, she's an untouchable caste. And she has two older brothers. Now, the average family in Nepal makes about $200 a year. And the reason why Inu is going to be disappeared is because her mother can't afford to send her to school, because you have to pay school fees after third grade. Well, what's gonna happen to Inu? And what we learn is that Inu will be smuggled across the border, and the Indian border is just 20 miles away through the jungle, where she is going to end up in a brothel, where her first day she's going to be raped between 10 and 15 times. By the time she's 14, she's going to be HIV positive, because men that frequent this brothel have AIDS, and they believe that if they have sex with a virgin, it will cure their AIDS. So Inu, who's standing over there, is going to be dead before she's 18. And that's after being indentured as a sex slave. And she's 12 years old. Now, what would you do? Inu is standing over there. I said to the principal, well, what would it cost to keep Inu in school? And he says to us, oh, way too expensive. Many rupees. Like, what are we talking about? Well, she needs a fall uniform and she needs a school uniform. She needs her books. She needs her school supplies for the year. She needs a bag to hold it. She needs one meal a day. And she has to pay school fees. All right, what are we talking about here? Too many rupees. 2,500 rupees for 1 year. That's $50. $50. What would you do? Inu is standing there. This isn't something you read about in a magazine, or you see on television, on CNN, or you read about. The little girl is standing there. What would you do? I reached into my pocket and I peeled off 2,500 rupees. I gave it to the principal and I said, Inu stays in school. I turned around and I started sobbing, because this is the single greatest thing I had ever done in my life. I've done a lot of cool things. You know, like many of you, I've devoted my whole life to service, but this is it. For 50 bucks, I just saved a little girl's life. The most important thing, I felt in that moment I could die happy that my whole life was redeemed. And I'm crying as I'm walking away. I didn't even speak to Inu. I couldn't get it together to do that. And Kiran, my deferential woman Nepali doctoral student who has such reverence for the white, you know, professor from America, approaches me and she's seeing I'm crying and she holds my hand. And she says to me, Jeffrey, you're feeling really good about yourself right now, aren't you? Boy, I taught her something. She knew how to reflect feelings. And I said, you're damn right. This is the best thing I've ever done in my life. And she says to me in a soft voice, what do you think's going to happen now? And I said, what do you mean what's going to happen now? I just saved that little girl's life. And she said, that principal put the money in his pocket. What do you think's going to happen after you leave? And I said, well, what are you saying? Like, that wasn't a good thing to do? And she says, Jeffrey, if you don't come back to check on her, she's not going to be here in another month. She's gone. And I can't come back to this godforsaken place. You know, it took me 3 days to get here. You know, I have a life back home. I have other things to do, other places to go, other students. This is the most remote place in the world. I can't come back here again. Then say goodbye to Inu. And then Kiran said to me, there are 12,000 girls from Nepal a year like Inu that disappear. What are you going to do about them? Shit. I never chose this path. It's nothing that I ever wanted. It's nothing that I ever planned for. But that was 10 years ago. I'm sorry. Inu is now 19 years old. And she's a first semester college student at the most elite university in Thailand. She has a full scholarship. She's the first girl in her village to ever go to university. She's on Facebook. You can find her on Facebook. And she just posted a photograph of herself because she's decided she wants to study radio and television communications. She never had electricity before in her life, never had indoor plumbing before in her life. She's living in a residence hall in Bangkok, this elite university, studying communications. So it's now 10 years later, and there's 146 girls that we're now supporting in Nepal that are in 9 different villages around the country. I leave on Thursday to go back there, and every year we visit every single one of these girls. Now, it takes me 7 weeks to visit every single girl. So, I don't know what the hell I'm doing. I was never trained in this. I never chose this path. But what's evolved completely from collaborations, and I'm just mentioning this not to promote this project, but just to show you how easy this is to do. You just reach in your pocket for $50. And I'm not talking about donating money to a charity. Please join the group. Come in the middle of the circle, or in the circle. I'm not talking about donating money to charity because this is what's really intriguing that I've spent my whole life to get ready for. What is it that we know as therapists, as family therapists, as brief therapists, that we could use what we know to make a difference in any community, in where you live or anywhere in Nepal or anywhere else in the world? And I'm going to say this again, I don't know what the hell I'm doing. So what happened the first few years, if it costs $50 to save a girl's life, shit, you know, let's find 6 more and let's go to another school and find. And how do we identify girls who are, number one, academically gifted, because we want to invest in girls that are going to have the most potential to actually make it. So back to Kiran's research. We finish this qualitative study in these villages, interviewing new mothers about their childbirth experiences. And what we discover is that the few women who end up going to hospital are, because they're all lower caste, are treated worse than animals. These men, because all the doctors are men, touch their private parts, which is they'd rather die than be humiliated. And these men doctors put snakes in their arms. IVs. Never explain what they are. They think they're snakes. They never explain what they are, what they're for. So the women go back to the village and say, never go to that place. It's better to die. And then we discovered that when a woman is having a difficult childbirth or a breech birth or some complication, it's the mother-in-law, the husband's mother, that makes the decision about whether she's allowed to seek medical care. And the mother-in-laws believe that if their daughter-in-law is having a difficult labor or difficult pregnancy, it's best for them to die so that their husbands can get stronger wives. So they allow their daughter-in-laws to die. So Kieran and I concoct this idea. We just make this up. This is crazy. This is just lunacy. What if we could grow the next generation of women doctors? What if we could handpick the most academically gifted lower caste girls, the ones that are most at risk to be sold into sex slavery, and what if we mentor them? And what if we give them scholarships to keep them in school? And what if we send them to medical school or to engineering school or to public policy or to be teachers? Because the girls in our villages have never heard of women before who work, who have professions, who have jobs. So this is crazy. But what if we could help Inu, this first girl, this is going back 8, 9, 10 years ago, what if we could help her go all the way? Well, first time we asked Inu what she wanted to be, she said she wanted to be a nurse, because that's the only other thing she heard that women could do. Second year we went to visit, she said she wanted to be a teacher, because her school only had male teachers. The third year, she decided she wanted to be a college professor. She wanted to teach other young women like herself. Actually, you can see her video also online, telling her story of what she wants to do now. So the first few years, if it cost $50 to save a girl, heck, think what we could do with $500. What's that? So next year, Kieran and I started funding this. We picked out 6 more girls in another village. Then we doubled it again. Now, it's at about this point that maybe I was talking to people at a conference and someone said, hey, you know, here's some money. Do something with that money. And I said, I don't know what to do with your money. Well, just do something with it. And that was a weird responsibility because I didn't want other people's money. I don't want to have to do paperwork and keep track of this. And then someone said, well, I want to give you some money to help, but I never heard of you. I never heard of this organization. Good reason, because we didn't exist. But how do I know what you're going to do with this money? And I said, well, why don't you come with us? You know, why don't you go meet the girls and meet the families themselves? Why don't you come and help me? I'm exhausted. And that is what started what, you know, 10 years later has now been like over 100 or 150 people that have gone with me, my graduate students and therapists and faculty and people from all over the world, a lot from Australia and a lot from Canada, but from Hong Kong and from Romania and from all kinds of places. And so what we invented, and we just made this up as we went along, I just love that. I love, we don't have an office. We don't have any paid staff. We don't have anyone on salary. Everybody pays their own expenses. So, you know, like all the things, if you thought about starting your own organization in your own community to whatever touches your heart, whatever movement is important to you, wherever you live, or whatever part of the world speaks to you, this is so incredibly easy to do. You just wouldn't believe it. It just takes $50 to make sure it gets in the right place with no overhead. And if you've been to places of the world where you see UNICEF and you see all these organizations, they stay in the Radisson, in the Hilton. They drive around in Range Rovers. They have six-figure salaries. You know, when people donate money to charities, you know what percentage of that money ever gets to the people they want to help? And then with corruption in a place like Nepal and Southern Asia, there's almost no money ever trickles down to help. And, oh, it's if you ever go to Kathmandu, you go to the Radisson Hotel, there's like all the United Nations and all these organizations staying in this $200 a night hotel, and you see their Range Rovers parked outside, you know, like seven of them in a row with the names of all their charities on the side. I'm not saying they're not doing good work, but I'm saying, now, you're using all your skill and your experience and your talent about how change takes place, how systemic, we're talking about systemic change. Because we're trying to change a whole culture to teach them to value girls and women. And they don't. We're messing with their culture. Now, when I say we, I have two Nepali partners, Kieran and another Nepali, as I was talking about in the previous program, I don't know what in the hell I'm doing most of the time. I speak a bit of the language. You know, I probably spent the equivalent of a year there over the last 10 years, or more. But I still don't know what's going on most of the time, so I have to rely on my partners. But it's primarily my graduate students who are almost all first-generation immigrants. They're Latina, they're all women. Latina, they're Asian, they're Middle Eastern, they're African, they're first-generation. And besides the countries they were born in, they've never left the country before, the U.S. And so people get together, and if any of you approach me afterwards and say, have you thought about doing this? My response to you, I'll save you the trouble. My response to you is, that's a great idea. I think you should do that. Because I don't have time to do any more. But the idea is to get together a group of like-minded people, maybe like those of us in the room, and to think about what project speaks to us. How is it that we can make a difference? Because there's so much talk. I'm so sick of social justice talk and social justice scolding and people, scholars writing articles and ethical codes saying, like, what are you actually doing? You know, the people that speak this and preach this, that's all wonderful, but what are you doing in your life? What are you doing in your community? What are you doing? So we'll get back to this at the end. If you know anything about me, everything I do ends up being a book, and this is going to be a book that's going to happen as a result of this conversation today. And I'm going to invite some of you to join me in this book if you want as well. How about that? How many programs have you been to where you get to invited to contribute a chapter to a book? Be thinking about that before we get to the end. So the idea is getting together a community of people to brainstorm not just ideas, but ideas in action. And I'm leaving on Thursday for Nepal again, and this time I'll only be there for 3 weeks because I come back for 3 days, and then I leave to teach social justice courses on semester at sea for 4 months. So I'm taking... Well, we have 600 students on board the ship. I have 90 students, and we're going to 14 countries. And every time we spend a week in port, I'm taking the students, and we're going to orphanages and schools and hospitals to work for a week, living in the communities in Lower Caste Village in southern India, living in a village 4 days up the Amazon River in the jungle, going to Ghana, going to South Africa, going to Cambodia. In each case, the students are placed in for 3 or 4 days to live in the village, to work beside them. And then when they come aboard ship, the classwork is to process their experience. Now, if there's anything that could transform people, it's got to be this, because lectures and classrooms can't touch that compared to what direct experience is. So I'm really, really intrigued with this phenomenon of how easy it is to get involved. And I'm also intrigued because, you know, every year probably 50 people contact me and say, that's really cool, I want to go, or I want to raise money for the girls, or I want to do this. And I say, fine, and I dutifully write everyone's email, I send them an itinerary. Less than 5 people end up following through, or 10 people, because life intrudes. There are so many reasons why we can't do this. We can't afford it. We can't get away from our jobs, from our clients. We have our families. We usually go over the Christmas holidays. And although I'm Jewish, we spend Christmas Day, I love Christmas, because we spend Christmas Day giving new scholarships to girls. We spend New Year's Eve and New Year's Day in the Himalayas, because we usually go on a trek afterwards to debrief, in the Himalayas, in the mountains, surrounded by 22,000 foot peaks and 23,000 foot peaks. And there are so many reasons why people say they can't do it. And the people that end up going, excuse my language, but they say, fuck it. Meaning, I'm going to do this and then I'll find a way to do it. My students are so poor, you know, in the Cal State University system, especially with budget cuts. I mean, we are the cheapest university in the country. You know, it costs like $5,000 a year to go to one of the Cal State campuses. Our students can't afford that. They can't afford $5,000 a year. So it costs $4,000 to go to Nepal with all the expenses and plane fare. Plus, they have to raise money. And the students or the people that say, this is what I'm going to do, they make the choice or decision, and then they find a way to make it work. And, of course, you've discovered that in your own practices, that, you know, how do we get our clients to change? Well, once they make a commitment to do it, once they make the decision, the rest falls in place. Somehow, some way, they borrow, beg, you know, find some way to do what it is that they, that their heart, that they really want to do most. And all the reasons why we say we can't do this, why we can't get involved, we don't have time, we have our families, we have more commitments. So this isn't a scolding, you know, lecture. I'm trying to inspire, I'm trying to set a stage for the conversation we're going to have in just a, oh my gosh, what time did we start? 9? Okay, good. So I got to stop talking in a minute so we can open this up. I'm just trying to set the stage to inspire each of you to get in more involved, not get involved, because just for the fact that you're in this room, that of all the choices you had of where you could go, you came here because there's something about this topic that inspires you. And I just want to tell you or reinforce whatever it is y'all are already doing, how easy this is. How easy it is to pick any place in the world or any place where you live and to figure out a way that you can fight for the rights of the people who are most oppressed. I just like, you know, I shared this in my program yesterday, you know, because this is a big year for me. I'm turning 60 next month, and I just don't feel like I have that much time left. I don't have that great a life expectancy anyway. And I'm just feeling even more frantic about what can I do with the time that I have left, however limited it is, to help the people that are most neglected. Because one of the reasons I got so burned out in private practice is that I thought, I'm okay at this, but anybody could do what I'm doing. I actually feel that about my job now at the university, and I've just made a decision to cut back to half time starting next year so I can spend more time finding more causes where I can devote my time, because I'm good at what I do, but anybody could do what I do. Anybody could do that. But giving thought, what are some missions? What are some service projects? What are some ideas where nobody is doing anything? And if you don't do it, it isn't going to get done. That's what I love thinking about. That's what I love talking about most. Where can we find a place? Where can we find a community? Where can we find a project? That if you don't do it, nobody in the whole world is ever going to do it, and it's not going to get done. Where can you find a group of people that have been so neglected and so marginalized and so impressed? You know, we talked about the word empowerment. I mean, that's what the name of our foundation is called, Empower Nepali Girls. That is finding the lowest caste, a lower caste girl is worth less than a goat. And if a choice between a goat and a girl, they'll let the girl die because she's totally worthless. And I just love going to the, and if, you know, you've read Greg Mortensen's books or whatever, then you know that he has a very similar philosophy. The idea of, you know, and he also makes fun of charities and organizations that go to the capital cities, to Karachi or to Mumbai or to these places, and that's where their headquarters is. And his philosophy is you go to the end of the road. You start at the end of the road where nobody has ever been, and then you work backwards from there. I just want to end these opening remarks before we open this up for comments and questions that I'm starting a new book project. You know, people all the time say, just this week. But just this week, I committed to do a new book project, and I can't remember the title, but it's going to be something like, you know, Practicing What We Preach or Walking the Talk. And then the subtitle is Therapists Involved in Social Justice. And I want to invite, and we sent the proposal out, and most of the people that we were thinking of inviting are the people like on the panels, you know, and the academics, and the reviewers appropriately and scornfully said, excuse my language, this is bullshit. You know, professors have discretionary time, you know, and if you're writing a book to inspire practitioners to get involved, why don't you have practitioners, you know, the best therapists in the world are not up on stage, or not us. You know, the people that are doing the most valuable work don't choose to talk about it, don't choose to write about it, don't choose to present about it, they just do it. So we're very interested in recruiting any of you or anyone you know who are involved in something in your community, that's some social justice action, some form of altruism, some activism in which you are working indirectly with your hands and feet and your heart and soul to make a difference somewhere. We're interested in having people to tell their stories, to write a chapter, to write a narrative about what it is that you're doing. So if that's something that interests you, you can email me later. I'm easy to find, or I'll be around here, or I think I have to run to another program right after this one, but we could chat for a moment. Anyway, that's what I've got to say, and I guess if I would summarize some of the main themes again, it is so darn easy to do this. You know, it sounds so complicated. It is hard now. I mean, we had to get registered as a 501c3, and now we have an accountant, and my son, who graduated from law school, we were his first client. You know, he graduated from law school, and he helped us to register as a 501c3, but there is some crazy accounting stuff that we have to do now, and, you know, a lot of accountability, you know, when you're a registered charity. It was a lot easier when everything was just under the table. But it's just so easy to do this on your own. You don't need an organization. You don't need a formal structure. And I love the fact that we have no high, you know, you hear the term grassroots. Now, I'm not even sure what that means, but I guess what I think it means is that we don't have any hierarchy, we don't have any power structure, that everybody is a volunteer, everybody is an equal partner. You know, when someone comes up to me and they say, I want to get involved, I say, great, what do you want your title to be? You know, make up a title, we'll get you business cards printed, you know. Anybody can do whatever it is that they want. And I love that as a model, you know, that we just hear so much about grassroots and about collaboration and about partnerships. Well, I think building communities of people with shared interests can do anything. I just believe we really can change the world. So I'd like to now, we have 18 minutes left. I'd like to open, this is supposed to be a conversation hour, so I'd just like to open this up for comments you'd like to make, anything you want to share, questions, so on, and we'll pass the microphone around. You need to speak into the microphone. 1 second.
I think I shared the most.
Hold it closer a little bit.
I probably shared the most a woman having been raised and brought up with social justice and all that you talk about in Green Bay, Wisconsin. So the end run of my life is that I've shared my son with your direction. He is in Africa. And if you're going to Ghana, I want you to be sure and send him all my love. He has married an African woman, and they have two children, and that's where he has located.
Great.
Doing exactly what you're doing.
Great. Yeah, could you pass the microphone? You're going to have to come forward a little bit because the cord is...
It really connects to your story. My daughter, when she was 20, dropped out of pre-med UC San Diego, went to Ghana, went to volunteer in a little town called Alavanyo. Her goal was to help... she was a biology major, so her goal was to help better agricultural practices, to teach them composting, just very simple things that they weren't using. And she came back. She started a 501c3 called Africa Alive Ghana. It still exists. It gives college credits. And she just did that by her own will, her guts. She raised money, $3,000 to start, just by family and friends. She'd meet people in a coffee shop. They'd end up writing her a check for $100 to Africa Alive. And so it was a microcredit for women. She went to the World Microcredit Conference with Muhammad Yunus before he won the Nobel Prize. He hugged her. He blessed her project. And it's still going. And that's what she did. She never went back to college.
Right.
Which is kind of a hardship for her parents, but hey, you know, that's her road.
But two more examples of just how easy it is to do this. Who else has a question or a comment? Yeah.
My question, of course, I'm totally for social justice for my entire life, and I would like to be doing these things. But the question is, how do you deal with the power structure? And in your story, it's the principal. It's also probably the government and the banks and the people that we're seeing more and more in this country have power. And we're in this war where what we're doing is bombing people rather than helping them. And this is supposedly a democracy where we have some say, but we have no say over that. So how do you deal with these macro structures, which are so much bigger than you are?
I don't deal with the macro structures. I mean, I can barely watch the news. You know, I can barely, you know, because so many of my students are undocumented immigrant, you know, undocumented students. I have a microphone. Are undocumented students. You know, my students graduate from a marriage and family therapy program and they can't get licensed in because they're not eligible. They can't be fingerprinted. And, you know, the DREAM Act, you know, just came up and it just got shut down again. So I feel so powerless and so frustrated and so angry. I can barely function. So I actually have a clear answer. I don't care about the macro structure. All I care about is what I can do in my little world. You know, with one girl or one family or in my, you know, with my friends or whatever. And to help spread the word that maybe we all go out in the world and try I don't know. I just, my solution is to bury my head in the sand about that which I cannot control and that which I can't do very much about, and to focus about how amazingly wonderful it feels to make a difference on a small scale. And in this one book recently, my co-author and I, his name is Mike Mariner, and Mike started, maybe you've heard of this, it's called Road Trip Nation. They've had documentaries on MTV and PBS. And what he does is he started out taking college students around the country in a green RV. Maybe you've seen these on television. And they go out, they take college students around to interview people. And he did it. They bought a used REV, our recreational vehicle. They now have a fleet, you know, of more than 100 recreational vehicles all over the world in which they take college students around to expose them to cultural diversity. We did this book, Changing People's Lives While Transforming Our Own, and what we did is we interviewed people that started grassroots organizations that had no, like the stories you just shared, that had no training and no preparation. And you've heard of some of these people, Tom of Tom's Shoes. Have you heard, you know, like they're the hip new shoes, at least in California. You know, they, for every pair of shoes you buy from Tom's Shoes for $30, he donates a pair of shoes to someone who doesn't have any. He does shoe drops. He flies over villages and drops shoes. He drives vans all over the third world, and every time he sees somebody without shoes, he stops and fits them with a pair of shoes. Born into Brothels, which won an Academy Award for Best Documentary Film. We interviewed her about, you know, her experience in India. We interviewed about a dozen people, and my absolute favorite, is a 13-year-old boy, 13 years old, who sees on television that there are AIDS orphans in Africa. And he says to his parents, I want to do something about this. And they say, great. And some of you are nodding your head because you may have seen his story on ESPN or something like that. We interviewed him. A 13-year-old boy decides he's going to start a shoot-a-thon. And he gets his family and friends to give him $1 for every free throw he makes. And so the first year he shoots 100 free throws, gets $100. Then his friends ask if they can help. And then it starts spreading viral across the United States. He raised 13-year-old boy raised $300,000 and built two orphanages in Africa to support AIDS orphans. He's 13 years old. So shit, if he can do that, you know, any of us can do that. And I prefer to pay attention or to focus on what it is that we can do than think about these macro issues that, I don't know, maybe you're a better woman than I am, but it just drives me crazy. I swear I just stopped getting the LA Times because I just can't read it anymore. And it's a liberal newspaper. I just can't read it anymore. Now I read the Huffington Post online, but I can do that. But I just get too overwhelmed and too frustrated and too depressed and too discouraged. And I just want to focus on what I can do with what is within my power instead of thinking about whether Sarah Palin's going to be our next president. Yes.
I mean, I'm real uncomfortable.
I'm sorry, though. We had a heart attack. We just have to, yeah.
I think it's wonderful what you're doing, but I'm really uncomfortable that you're advocating putting our heads in our sands at one of the biggest crises our country's ever been in. And I feel a little, schizophrenic's not the word, but I feel very disconnected here at this conference that, I mean, we're at a point in our country where we're criminalizing looking Hispanic. You know, we're legalizing racism and fear-mongering, and to advocate putting our heads in the sand is terrifying.
I'm not suggesting that you should put your head in the sand. I'm saying that's the question was, what is my response? And what I do is focus within what is within my power to do. I think that you absolutely should operate on a macro level. I think that you should too. I think we should all do whatever speaks to our heart. But it's about not talk. It's about action.
Well, and I think that one of the things that's been of concern to me, you know, professionally and being at the conference is that, I mean, our profession is predominantly one-on-one therapy or group therapy or family therapy. But when your clients continually come in and say, I'm feeling increasing dread, what should I do about it? Well, the answer at this point may not be within any dysfunction in your family or any, you know, self-talk that's problematic. It might be actually good reality testing. And I don't see an answer for that kind of, I haven't been trained to really contend with that within the framework of being a psychologist. As a person, as a neighbor, as a friend, I have, but not as a psychologist.
Great, thank you. And thank you for making that point about...
Okay, thanks. I just want to respond because I know I feel the same sense of despair and frustration about the macro level. And I think I appreciate what you said. You can do both. You can choose. I'm not good on that part, but I might be better on this part, or somebody else might be better on the bigger issues. So I think we all have to act. But on the training part, I just want to say something because I'm a psychologist, but I teach in a counselor ed program. And counselor education has really started embracing training our students that they can't be a therapist without being skilled at doing that part too. The social advocacy, social justice advocacy. So we require our students in the second year of our program, I'm just local here at Rollins College, to do 100 hours of service, working with somebody who's doing any one of the things and who can show them as in a mentor role and guide them to do social justice advocacy for the very reasons you said. So I think we're moving that way. Counselor education, as social works, are always been there, right? Psychology, I think, is still talking about it intellectually from my perspective. They've got some good statements out. They've talked about it, but, you know, I haven't been on my training program about 10 years, 12, no, a little more than that, about 15 years, I guess. But there was nothing going on there, and I don't think that's happening. So I think that's something within the profession we need to say is we don't have this training, and we need to know how to do that, because how can we help our clients? It's not about them. It's about their context. It's about their... So I think there are some things going on, and I just wanted to say that. His book's going to be really helpful in that way.
Just on the same thing, being a therapist here, the wonderful utilization, the problem is a message. And this is what we do. We have a client who comes in and just like then it says, oh my God, you just said I'm crazy. And you say, fantastic, fantastic. Now where do we go from that? Which is exactly where you took off from then. So your immediate response of, just a minute, I heard, and then you're saying, no, you misheard. But wow, fantastic. Now we got somewhere. Which is this wonderful thing is, it is so easy to mishear what we're doing, because we're so stressed about the disturbance and the horribleness that is going. I've just come back from India, and I know just what you're talking about. And that's the point. And that's wonderful. When you do that and you go, do exactly what you just did then. Say, wow, the problem is a message. And the message is, you don't know enough about that? No, the problem is not you don't know enough about that. The message is, I don't know enough about that. I think I'll go learn. And where do I do? So then we have this conversation. There was a wonderful thing I saw Jean Houston do, probably at the 2005. And she stood up and she got someone out to say who's doing work. And it was a chap who's doing work with the Native Indian. I don't know what you... There's all different names for everybody, but the Native Indians. The Indians. Anyway, there they were. The people, who are the indigenous people. And she said, what are your problems? And blah, 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 and he talked about it. And she said, good. And there were 1,000 people in the audience. And she said, okay, who can help him? And exactly as you've done now in a large audience. And someone came out and said, well, I'm a lawyer. And someone came out and said, well, I got a tractor, and someone said this, and there were 20 people out the front, because Jean did exactly that. She said, okay, that's the problem. No, the problem is you don't have enough people to help you. Who can help you? And away you go. And to all I'm doing is actually just hopefully just bringing in everything that's just been said of it. That's all I'm trying to do. I'm
Lovely
not trying
summary.
To say anything more. Yeah. Yeah.
Time for one or two quick comments or questions or things people would like to share. Yeah.
Could you share your reading list? What do you read?
What do I read?
Yeah, what do you read?
Oh, I'm going to get in trouble again saying this out loud, but...
That's a good start.
Yeah. From someone who writes therapy books, I'm really bored with therapy books. You know, I go in the bookstore and I look at them and I just can't... So here's my answer. I love reading stories and narratives of people making a difference. That's what inspires me. I don't mean to over romanticize what we're doing, what any of us are doing, because it is such fucking hard work. It's exhausting. When I'm in Nepal on Thursday, I am crying most of the time. I'm jet lagged. I'm tired. I'm overwhelmed. I'm so frustrated. I'm so confused because I don't understand what's going on, and I understand like one out of every 10 words, and you know, it's just I feel like I'm going to explode, and I there's no time to recover, and it is the hardest work, and I need inspiration. I guess this is the program I wanted to go to. And I think sometimes the programs I do are the ones that I want to go to just because I can't sit still for very long. As much as I'd love a three-hour workshop, I can't sit still for 3 hours. I got to do something. So this is the program I always wanted to go to be able to have a conversation about this. And the things that I read, you know, I read fiction and I read narratives of people who make a difference in the world. That's what. And my favorite one, you know, like maybe in the last year, is called Half the Sky. It won a Pulitzer Prize, and I just finished reading Mortensen's new book, you know, Stones into Schools, which is much cooler than the first one because it's
Beggar to the Poor.
Beggar to the Poor.
So yeah. He lends the poorest of the poor, which are women in Bangladesh, he lends them little tiny loans, so it keeps them from being prostitutes, basically. Yeah. It allows them to sew clothing and sell them in the market. And all the amazing thing is that because it's a village culture, all the loans are paid back 100%. Yes. So that other people,
right.
Other
I mean,
women can receive the loans. It's such an inspiring book. It's called Beggar to the Poor. This is his first book.
Thank you all so much for being part of our community. And just one more time before we leave, just look around the room one time and just make eye contact with everyone here, that maybe what we hold on to is what it felt like to be in the room today with each other. And
just one sentence. And you, this hit you.
Nobody can hear you. Hold on.
This hit you when the possibility occurred when you were 50.
Never too late.
It's never too
late.
Okay, thank you so much for coming.